Are police given preferential treatment by our courts in the United States? Who should we hold accountable when police officers are proven to wrongfully shoot and kill someone, yet nothing is done by our so-called justice system? Where are families supposed to turn when the very same people who are sworn to protect them turn their backs? We discuss these questions and more in this episode of Archangels of Justice Weekly. Hello and welcome to Archangels of Justice Weekly. I am your host, Joe Rost, and as always, I am joined today by Sal and Ira. This week, we're going to do things a little different and talk to Sal and Ira only about two cases they worked on involving police shootings in Wisconsin. These cases involve the deaths of Michael Bell and Michael Funk, who were both killed by police under what can only be described as dubious circumstances. These cases happen all over the country to people of all color, and yet still law enforcement officials are rarely charged with the crime. Ira, since you worked pretty extensively on with both these cases and you were the first one involved, why don't you explain the two cases, starting with Michael Bell?
On November 9th, 2004, Michael Bell had been out with a couple of friends of his and had been stopped by a City of Kenosha, Wisconsin police officer for some alleged speeding violation, which turned out was false. And he says he had been having trouble with the Kenosha police, apparently, because they had been stopping him and harassing him, or that was in his opinion. And walked away from the police and went to the back of his house in the backyard, and the police called for help, and pretty soon they had four officers there, three regular officers, and one was a lieutenant. And the Kenosha police got in a physical altercation with him, claiming that they eventually were all so exhausted they couldn't get control of him. And that one of them started yelling, "He's got my gun," or words to that effect. And when Michael Bell was stopped for this alleged speeding violation, walked away, and they got in an altercation in the backyard of Michael Bell's mother's house. And during that time, the police shot and killed Michael Bell. And then they done it so improperly, they made a fictitious story, made it up, and tried to justify their actions, which they just couldn't. And ultimately, Michael Bell's father sued the Kenosha Police Department and was awarded $1.75 million in a settlement.
So what did the Kenosha Police Department have to say about this lawsuit?
Well, the police testimony was that Michael Bell had allegedly grabbed the officer's gun, but there was no evidence to show that he had done that. There was no DNA or anything on the officer's holster or on the gun at all. And they used that excuse as a reason for putting the gun up to the side of Michael Bell's head and shooting him and killing him. So they went to deposition on the lawsuit, and they found that the officers had lied on everything.
What did the officers claim happened in the aftermath of the shooting?
Well, the police officers came up with this story. They claimed that Michael Bell had grabbed the officer's gun, and they were all spent. They had no strength left to subdue him, and they were forced. One of the officers that arrived there put a gun up to the side of Michael Bell's head and shot once, and eventually Michael Bell died from the wound. The problem was is that the officers had made up their story to justify the shooting, and the versions they made and kept changing absolutely show that they were lying. There's no doubt about it. I wrote an affidavit to the FBI several years ago, but they must have lost my number. They haven't contacted me yet.
But I mean, it seems pretty clear to me that if you pull a trigger from the side of someone's head, that is murder. So how did the police officers try to explain this?
Yeah, there were several reconstructions done in this case by the officers involved in the shooting, where they themselves reenacted the struggle and then ultimately the shooting. Well, each reenactment was different than the first one that they did. You know, they none of them were the same. They were trying to match it up to the way the crime scene reconstruction would have shown it. Well, amazingly, even though they knew and had seen the reconstruction, they still couldn't reconstruct the events themselves. That's just how ludicrous their attempts were. And like Iris said, they claimed that they were exhausted. Four full-sized men, law enforcement officers, were exhausted struggling with one man that they had to resort to shooting him, who was unarmed, by the way. And as I reviewed the crime scene photos and the autopsy reports, that all conflicts with the officer's testimony, and it conflicts with their tape recorded or video recorded reconstruction attempts. How these guys were allowed to keep their jobs amazes me. Again, Mr. Bell, the father, he won the lawsuit, but that in and of itself, he's used most of that money in order to, get some kind of legislation and things changed in regards to police officer involved shootings. But the fact of the matter is those officers should have been arrested. They actually committed a murder. This wasn't a shooting in self-defense. The claim that, oh, he's got my gun, it was nothing more than a misinterpretation on his part, where, they're in this struggle up against this car, and there's a broken mirror on the side of the car, on the driver's side of the car, which, the officer could have got tangled up on that mirror and broke it. And it was pushing down on this holster or whatever the case may be. But, Michael Bell never had that firearm. Michael Bell's hands were both on the car the whole time as the officers were struggling with him. His hands never escaped control of the law enforcement officer. So, the claim of him having the gun was nothing more than, that officer, that particular officer, making a claim that wasn't true. And, these guys got away with it. And like I said, there shouldn't have been an arrest in this case. These officers were criminal in their behavior. In the beginning of the scene, when he first was stopped, the officer that stopped him basically ran up to the car while Michael Bell was standing outside of his truck door, grabbed Michael Bell by the jacket, and dragged him off camera to the rear of the police car. So the officer had shown and exhibited an enormous amount of aggression with Michael Bell immediately, when there was no cause for it. Michael Bell was not offering any resistance whatsoever, and the whole time the officer was dragging him to the rear of the car, Michael Bell didn't fight back. He let him take him back there. And then you can hear them arguing back there briefly, not really an argument as much as a, why are you stopping me kind of a thing. And then a scuffle ensues, and that's when Michael ran to the back of the house, to his mother's house, and where they ultimately wound up killing him on the front of the car, which belonged to his mother. I'm assuming was a small sedan, private sedan that was in the backyard. And, it's a sad case because the police department investigated their own. It wasn't a matter of any other agency involved in the case. And, they basically justified the shooting, but the lawsuit proved that the shooting was not justified, that it was a wrongful death, and that the officers used excessive force, or Mr. Bell would have never collected $1.5 million. And to allow these officers to continue working is another travesty.
Did the officers' statements change at all during this time?
One of the things here, Joe, is that during from the actual time of the incident, through the depositions, through the written statements that they made, Officer Gonzalez, who was the shooting officer, gave six different versions. and Lieutenant Krieger, who was in charge of the scene, gave 6 different versions. Another officer gave 3 versions, and Officer Strasba, who claimed that they were taking Mike Bell was removing his gun from his holster or had taken it, gave 3 different versions, and none of them matched. And Strasba eventually committed suicide. Then the facts of the case, their versions that they wrote were just all false, and their testimony was all false. They lied under oath. And then they made, in the last deposition, when Lieutenant Krieger was getting finished after he had testified that Michael Bell had been shot in the right side of the head and a gun being held right up against his head, which they all had testified to, then the medical examiner report was brought out, and it showed that he was shot actually in the left side of the head. They had lied about everything they said. So then they created a video trying to justify what had gone on. This is when the insurance attorneys were involved. And they created 4 videos, and they were all inconsistent with the evidence. None of them matched what had gone on. And then the state of Wisconsin Department of Justice, by the Attorney General of the state of Wisconsin, Brad Schimmel, BS as I call him, had a complete investigation done. And the key words are complete and thorough investigation, because that means we did a phony job here. And they found that it was a justified shooting after they lied on everything. Now, the depositions and the reports were all false. It wouldn't have been a very much trouble charging them with writing false reports or committing perjury. And the videos were false. They hired these experts that were hacks to say that, oh, yes, these officers did a wonderful job. Everything they did was consistent with the procedures. And then these officers were never charged with committing any violations, and ultimately were commended for the wonderful job they did of killing Michael Bell. It was actually murder.
And in the immediate aftermath of the shooting, what did the officers write in their reports or even disclose to the media?
Well, the media, they weren't involved with these statements, but I've got notes here. Officer Gonzalez, the first version of the shooting, and these are from the excerpts of his original statement given to the investigating detective. I then ran around the front of the silver car because I couldn't get an angle on the suspect. I got around the front of the car. I put my gun to the subject's head. I really don't know which side of the suspect's head. This is all happening so fast. I put my non-gun hand, left hand, up to guide my weapon toward the suspect's head and pulled the trigger, and nothing happened. I saw that I had jammed the gun slide, not allowing the gun to fire. Because when you put the gun up against something and push the slide back a little bit, the gun will not function. I pulled the gun back and repositioned it. As I was repositioning the gun, I heard Lieutenant Krieger yell, "Shoot!" I fired almost simultaneously because I was already trying to shoot. I shot into the suspect's head. The second one said, in his testimony, "Do you remember telling them that you were in front of the Nissan when you shot Mr. Bell?" Gonzalez says, "Yes." "And that Nissan you were standing in front of the time you and that's the Nissan you were standing in front of at the time you shot Michael Bell?" "Correct." "Can you describe Mr. Bell's position when you shot him?" "Mr. Bell was between two officers bent over." "Bent forward?" "Yes." "And what side of the head did you press the muzzle of the gun against?" "At this time, I don't recall." "Were you ever between Lieutenant Krieger and Officer Strasba before you pulled the trigger?" "No." His third version was at another deposition. It's a request for admissions where they request that the witnesses answer questions in writing. They wanted him to admit that Gonzalez did not shoot Michael Edward Bell in the left side of the head. And he admitted it and he admitted that Albert Gonzalez, this was the officer's name is Gonzalez, shot Michael Bell in the right side of the head. Admit. The fourth version were taken from his deposition from April 15th of 2008. Was there any discussion about how you could have shot Mr. Bell in the right side of the head if you were standing in front of the car at the time you pulled the trigger? There might have been, sir. Again, I don't recall all of the... So you are aware that there's a claim by the plaintiff that you were standing on the right side of Mr. Bell at the time you shot him? Yes, sir. Were you aware that in June 2007, when you had that meeting? Yes, sir. Was it your understanding that on December 12, 2007, videotape was an attempt to demonstrate where you were standing at the time you shot Michael Bell? Answer, you're saying attempt, sir. That is the position I was in when I shot Michael Bell. It is your understanding that the purpose of the December 12, 2007 video was to depict where Michael Bell was standing at the time or positioned at the time you shot him? Yes, sir. Do you have any reason to believe that Mr. Bell's head could have changed positions from the left side facing you to the right side facing you in between the two trigger pulls? Again, sir, I don't know. And his fifth version said, on October 31st, 2008, he swore and signed an affidavit where he shot Michael Bell, and these are the relative portions. 25, I got around the front of the car, I pulled my service weapon out of my holster, put it to the suspect's head, I put my left hand up to guide the weapon toward the subject's head. The black X on the attached Exhibit 37 shows where I was standing when I fired. 26, I pressed my gun to the suspect's head and pulled the trigger, and nothing happened. I saw that I had jammed the gun slide, preventing the gun from firing. This is called being out of battery. 27, I pulled the gun back and repositioned it. As I was repositioning the gun, I heard Lieutenant Krieger yell, shoot. I fired almost simultaneously because I was already trying to shoot into the suspect's head. In his sixth version, he claims what had happened is they tried to show that Gonzalez was now tilting his gun a little bit because the way he had shot was inconsistent with the branding. When you have a contact gunshot wound, it leaves a brand on the victim. So they said, okay, that's fair. Are you aware of the fact that the plaintiff's experts have said that the shell casing was found after the shooting is inconsistent with the orientation of the firearm that you described in your testimony? Yes, sir. I know there's a discrepancy with the shell casing. And he goes on to say, he, meaning you, Officer Gallus, he also canted his weapon counterclockwise to simulate, to the best of his recollection, the angle he held his duty weapon when he shot Michael Bell on November 9th, 2004, correct? And again, that was Mr. Willis's understanding as contained in his report. That is Mr. Willis's understanding, and that was your intent, yes. Now, Willis was one of these former police officers and an instructor at one of the community colleges who purports to he's an expert witness that comes in to support the police all the time. He never takes a contrary position, as I understand it, to what the police say. And then on April 30th, 2007, Gonzalez previously testified under oath in a deposition to the following: did you have your arm extended and the gun pointed at Mr. Bell's head? The gun was slightly canted. In which direction? I believe it would have been in the right direction. So you had your hand slightly turned to the right. Answer, correct. Every one of these statements that this Officer Gonzalez made was contrary to the other ones. And they were making it up after they found out that they had testified, and they didn't find out for 2 years that Michael Bell was actually shot in the other side of the head that they claimed he was. They had all changed their positions on while they were pretending that they were doing a great job. They had to make up their stories because they knew they had murdered Michael Bell. You don't have to lie if you do the job properly.
These officers wrestled with Michael Bell and then, according to the physical evidence, put a gun to his head and pulled the trigger?
And according to the original statements, yes, and the original reports.
So I want to be clear on this. According to the physical evidence and the statements, the barrel was put to Michael Bell's head and the trigger was pulled?
Yes.
There was no evidence that this was done from a distance?
No, the barrel was the muzzle of the weapon was put right against Michael Bell's head when they fired the weapon, when Gonzalez fired the weapon. But they didn't have the reason to do it, the proper reasoning to do it, and they just made a apparently in our the affidavit and from the experts that we have, Gonzalez ran right up, pulled out his gun, and shot him in the side of the head. And then they had to make the story because one of the officers, you know, said, "What did you do?" And then from there, they had to do it to cover Gonzalez because Gonzalez would have gone to prison for murder.
What was the reason given for the police being there in the first place?
Well, they said that he had been speeding, but the videos show that he was way away from them when they claimed that happened. And Michael Bell had already stopped the vehicle and was out of the car when the officer finally pulled up. And but we've got the videos from the police car dash cam that shows that they really didn't have the grounds. And then as this investigation went on, from there they kept getting caught worse and worse. You know, the facts speak for themselves. When you pull the trigger of a gun, the shell in an automatic or semi-automatic weapon, the shell is ejected to the side, normally the right side, unless there's an attachment on there to eject it to the left. And what happened is they turned around and the shell was found in a certain place. The wounds were different from what these officers said, and yet they were lying about everything, and the evidence wasn't lying. And the police department and the attorney general's office ruled the shooting justifiable, and how they could do that was terrible. And then soon after this case, Michael Bell, and I was involved in a peripheral matter on this, Michael Bell had sought legislation, which was passed, and I was there when the governor signed it, saying that there had to be independent investigations anytime there was a police-involved shooting death. But they just found another way around to get it. They let the attorney general's office do it. And by doing that, it was just a cover-up. This is all a fraud, this gun. And now Gonzalez is working across the state line in Illinois teaching gun safety. Isn't that a joke?
So are all these officers that were proven to have lied in their statements and on their depositions, are they still on the force in some way?
No, Krieger, I understand, retired, and he was the lieutenant. And Strasbaugh, who was claiming that he had that Bell had removed his gun from his holster, committed suicide.
But none of them faced any criminal liability. It's pretty sad. Sal, is there anything you would like to add to this case?
Well, I think, you know, Ira covered it mostly. It's one of those travesties in justice again, where you have four officers on one unarmed man and can't control him. And instead of just backing off and re-engaging with tasers or something else, they decide to deploy deadly force. And, you know, this Gonzalez character who you know, put the gun to Michael's head the first time, he must have pushed the gun so hard against his head that it pushed the slide back, which we refer to that as being the gun is now out of battery. And when it's out of battery, the striker inside the firearm will not hit the firing pin when you pull the trigger. It won't. So he had to reposition the gun, you know, so the slide would move forward again in the proper position. So when he pulled the trigger, the gun would go off. Now, you know, he can recollect all that, but he seems to not be able to recollect other things, which are very important. So, you know, again, when you look at the physical evidence that doesn't lie, the physical evidence being the blood spatter and the imprint of the muzzle on Michael's head, those things don't lie. Those things are there. And it's an obvious case of murder. This is not a case of defensive shooting. This is a homicide. And these police officers should have been charged with homicide. But they weren't. Essentially, you got two or three guys holding Michael Bell in place while the other guy assassinates him or executes him, whatever choice of words you prefer. But that's what it is. You know, there was a point in time when police officers shooting an unarmed person was considered a real travesty. Nowadays, it's becoming more commonplace all the time, and it's absolutely disgusting based on the training and experience that police officers have. But what they do utilize in their training and experience is the magic words. I was in fear for my life. Oh, he's got my gun, or he's this or that. They come up with something that allows the state attorney or the Department of Justice, whoever it may be in that particular state, that charges an officer or not charges an officer with a crime, to not charge him. You know, in the state of Florida, in many other states, there's a grand jury. So you have 12 people from the community that sit in the grand jury and they listen to evidence and they can question every officer and every person that comes in to testify in that shooting. And their questions can make a decision on whether or not the state's going to charge or not. If the grand jury comes back and says, charge the officer with murder, then the state attorney has no choice but to do that because the grand jury has ordered it. But apparently in Wisconsin and many other states, it really, really is, belongs to, it, it is up to the state attorney in that state to file charges. And they basically won't because the investigation is usually performed by the agency involved in the shooting or another neighboring police agency or maybe even a state agency that, of course, you know, doesn't want to see an officer charged with murder in these kind of cases. And it's sad because did you four officers, if they're not capable of restraining one man, they shouldn't even be out on the job. They shouldn't even be there.
You know, there's something else involved here too. The actual scene and the reenactment show that the officers were along the side of the car on the driver's side. There was one officer, and then Michael Bell was there, and then another officer, and then Gonzalez on the right. And then what happened is when they put their reports together and testified, they claimed that he was over the front of the hood facing the windshield, but he wasn't. He was actually on the side of the car. So they had to change everything around to make a story to hopefully that would, you know, exonerate them, and nobody cared except the family. And the taxpayers got stuck with $1.75 million payment.
And in the aftermath of Michael Bell's death, they actually gave one of the officers an accommodation?
I think they gave them all something. It wasn't like the Medal of Valor, but it was some kind of commendation for... I don't know how they can justify this crap. That's my understanding.
Ira, to the best of your knowledge, has the state of Wisconsin ever charged an officer in a wrongful death case?
God, I really can't recall any. I think they have a couple of times, but they deliberately lost the cases. They pretend about how they're all puffed up about prosecuting the officer, and yet what turns around is that they wind up playing a game and helping the officer by not really vigorously prosecuting him, while the state, while the police department has all their flunkies and witnesses come in there and tell the jury how the great job they did. There was a case about 40 or 50 years ago, another guy named Bell, I think his name was Daniel Bell, and he was an African-American, and he was shot and killed by two officers. And 30 years later, one of the officers came forth and said, Daniel Bell did not have a knife, as was the officer had said he did, and they planted it on him. And the officer eventually went to prison that had killed him. But that was just because the officer couldn't live with himself anymore because he had participated in a cover-up. And they got that officer, the one that was the honest one, to tell, or the more honest one, to tell and get the defendant officer on the phone and get some statements, and they recorded them, and they were able to convict the officer. There's a lot of outrage, And you can understand why people throughout the country are tired of this, because there's no honest review of the homicides that are caused by the police. There's just what the police say. You know, when you say you and a policeman are shot and killed, when the policeman is shot and killed by a citizen, they tell, here's the guy's name, here's what he did, here's his record, here's his family name, and they put it all in the news. When the officer does something, the police aren't saying anything what happened. They're not identifying the officer. It's always the same crap. So what's happening there is the police are getting favorite and special treatment above the defendant. They can also wait 3 or 4 days before they have to give a statement so they can get it all together and you know, fabricate whatever they want. And that's the way it's going on, and that's what's got to be changed.
The reason I asked, because there was another shooting you both investigated involving the Wisconsin police officers, where they shot a hostage, Michael Funk, 7 times in the back and then an additional 2 times while he's on the ground. Michael didn't match the description of the suspect and was actually known by the local police. Talk a little bit about what happened in that case.
Well, I believe that was December 15th of 2015, and it was in Neenah, Wisconsin, where a guy named Flatoff had a complaint or a beef against a motorcycle dealership, the Eagle Nation Motorcycles. And there was a hardworking group of people in this motorcycle repair shop. And he thought that he got cheated when he sold a motorcycle to them. So he came in there with a gun in the early morning, Saturday morning, and held Michael Funk and 3 others hostage. A couple of guys had escaped and were in the basement, and they recorded everything on the police scanners and the dispatchers, and it was an absolute fiasco. They knew that Michael Funk was heading towards the door. They also knew that he had a concealed weapon. He had a concealed carry permit in Wisconsin. And after the police at one point came charging in, which what they called a hasty team. They were they hasty. And they went round and round, well, 2 of them fell down the stairs into the basement. One lost his gun. I mean, it was a real, old-time kind of a ridiculous way police did things. They all ran out of that place again. One of the officers had gotten shot in the helmet, the protective helmet, and his bell rung. He was kind of dazed from there, but he wasn't injured. So that officer violated the orders to stand down and to let the other officers do it, and hit around the corner. And when Michael Funk came running out, he ducked behind a car. He got his gun out of his holster, and he was looking at the doorway, trying to protect himself, hoping that this Flatoff wouldn't come out there and shoot him. And then he turned and he started to run away, never pointed his gun at anybody. And 2 officers used automatic rifles and shot him, as you said, 7 times in the back. And then he fell down, and one of the officers, I thought I saw him move a little, so I shot him 2 more. And then they left him stay there for quite an extended period of time before they removed the body. And when one of the officers said to the other, "Shouldn't we give him some help?" The shooting officer said, "F him, let him die. I don't care if he dies," or words to that effect. And all the officers, the 2 officers involved in there, got the Medal of Valor for shooting this guy in the back when they didn't have cause. And that was all recorded on video. And again, the Attorney General of Wisconsin, Brad Schimmel, BS, came in there and ruled it justified, and he had never even read the reports or saw anything about it. And he didn't even know much about the case when they were talking to him about it.
So when did you guys get involved with this case, and during your investigation, what did you find?
Well, almost immediately, Ira got involved in the case, and he called me, and I started reviewing the tape-recorded assessment of the shooting of Michael Funk. A couple things that Ira didn't mention, and I'll go ahead and mention them now, is that the hostage taker was in communication the whole time with 911. You know, they were tape recording a conversation, and then some of the people that had called 911 from inside also been recorded, and they gave a full description of the hostage taker, flat off, who was wearing clothing that in no way, shape, or form came even close to what Michael Funk was wearing. Michael Funk was wearing all black, Eagle Nation work shirt, which was a long sleeve shirt with Eagle Nation on it, and black pants, where the flat off was wearing jeans and a bright colored shirt and was wearing a hat. None of that matched Funk. The other thing that is sickening is that when this Hasty team, comprised of the Keystone cop routine, went into the building, they forced themselves in. Essentially, their reasoning was to rescue the hostages. They get into a shootout with flat off. Probably about 19 to 20 rounds go off in the building. And then the next thing you see on the dash cam is this Hasty team running out the door, falling all over themselves to escape being shot at by flat off. Now, these guys went in with a movable bunker, which is a shield. They are all wearing bulletproof vests, heavy vests, and helmets. And he scared them so much with his reaction that they all ran out like chickens. And then they go hide behind a building. And during this particular time, within a few seconds, you hear the hostage takers on the phone with 911 again. And he's berating them. And Michael Funk is standing there, obviously. And he says to Funk, "Close that door." Well, the door he's referring to is the door that the officers had came in through. And he says to him, "If you run away, I'll shoot you." So Funk, as he's nearing the door, decides to take advantage of that open door and takes off. And you hear a gunshot, but you don't know if flat off hit him or not. But Funk hits the ground, and he kind of rolls and then crawls, and he gets behind a vehicle that's parked out in front of Eagle Nation on the street. And as Ira mentioned, Funk goes ahead and he takes his concealed weapon out from under his shirt, and he's facing the door of the building, waiting to see if flat off is going to come out. It's obvious what he's doing. And at that point, you know, Funk decides it's best to retreat even further, and he starts to turn and go away, but he's not pointing his weapon at anybody. He's trying to get away. And then you just hear the gunshots and Funk fall. You don't hear any warning. You don't hear nothing, just gunshots. Now, the police try to claim that they gave Funk a warning to drop his gun, which is an outright lie because the videotapes never picked it up. And, you know, the sad part about it is the dispatcher who was on the phone with the hostage taker heard him say to Funk, "If you run out that door, I will shoot at you." Well, she never relayed that information to the people out in the street either, and she should have. She said, "Listen, one of the hostages has just been warned that if he runs out the door, he's going to get shot." You know, and then the officer should have used discretion. You know, you're trained to use discretion in a hostage situation. If you're going to put together a Hasty team, which you're supposed to deal with active shooters, they're supposed to be able to use discretion. Now, these men were all hiding behind a building. They were behind a building which offered them not only protection, but it offered them concealment. Funk had no idea they were where they were at. None of these officers were exposed to any shooting from anyone, whether it was flat off or Funk. None of them. None of them were in any danger, and yet they chose to shoot this man in the back. And then when he lay there dying in the street, shoot him two more times to add insult to injury, and then let him die. This is another sickening case of police officers using deadly force in a situation that's uncalled for. You know, if you're dealing with a deadly shooting situation and officers go into a building, they just can't shoot the place up. You know, you have hostages in there. You have to know the difference. And if you don't know the difference, you shouldn't have your job. And this guy came out of that building alone. He wasn't dressed like the hostage taker. He was not threatening anyone. They should have ordered him to the ground and then disarmed him and then escorted him away and then found out who he was. And the sad part is most of these officers knew who Michael Funk was. He's not like he was a stranger in the area. This is a small town. This isn't some metropolis where, oh, we don't know who this guy is. It's just another case. And then the mayor in that town who owns a trophy shop was the one that awarded the Medal of Valor. This is the case of an absolute travesty of justice. This is another murder, and the police got away with it.
Was there any wrongful death suit in this case?
Yes, there was. And the wife of Michael Funk sued, and apparently they lost the case. They didn't collect anything.
You know, the sad part with that is when you review their case, they didn't really hire any experts in SWAT. They didn't hire any experts in how you formulate and train a team to deal with an active shooter. Because if they had the training that these guys received, they must have got out of a Cracker Jack box. Because it's absolutely disgusting. One of the body cameras on one of the officers I watched shows him repeatedly on his way to the building, to where they're staging up before they go in. He repeatedly checks his magazine, taking it out, putting it back in, taking it out, putting it back into the firearm. And I'm sitting there going, it almost reminded me of watching a video game where these kids play these video games and they're constantly checking their magazine. I'm going, look, if you're a professional and you insert a loaded magazine into that weapon that you know is fully loaded, when you went in there and you put a round in the chamber, you know you got anywhere from 15 to 25 rounds, you don't need to keep checking it. So obviously this clown was ready for action and he thought he was going into a war game. And you know, the sad part is when you shoot live ammunition to a human body, it's not going to get back up in most cases. And like in a video game. And they murdered this man, and they should be paying for it. And some of them should be in prison, especially the one that refused to stand down when his sergeant ordered him to do so. And he was one of the shooters.
There's another thing, too. The reports that were put together by the Department of Justice, I don't believe were contradicted by any major experts. In the civil trial, I could be wrong, but I haven't heard of any. And when you're fighting the Department of Justice, who the citizens want to believe are, you know, sterling and always tell the truth, and you know they like the old, they ride their horses and sing at the same time. You don't get fairness in these courts. And you know, I contacted the attorney and told him that, you know, left messages, be glad to help. Nobody contacted me. Nobody contacted Sal. It was well known that I wrote that affidavit. It was in all the news. I filed a complaint with the Fire and Police Commission, and they did everything they could to get rid of me. And then they said, okay, we're going to listen to the case and every other complaint you have. And it became obvious to me right then and there that they were going to dismiss the whole thing. And I just withdrew the complaint, and everybody agreed that I was right doing it.
So in cases like this, what do you guys see as a solution to prevent police officers from killing unarmed suspects or in the other case, hostages?
Hold them responsible for their actions. If they do something wrong, be honest. Because there are so many people in this country that have had a relative or a family member shot and killed by the police, and everybody knows that they're not always right. And do something about it. Don't let these officers get away with it, because it just happens more and more. Last year we had the FBI doesn't even keep statistics on how many people are shot and killed by the police. They claimed that they had records on 560 of them, but actually there were almost 1,200 people that were killed by the police. And the FBI doesn't keep records on it, because if they kept records, they'd have to do something about it. And the FBI will not. They're part of the problem. They are the problem.
I was speaking more about prevention, because I know a lot of times these decisions are made in a split second, but these two cases we highlighted are clearly wrongful deaths at the hands of police. Are there things we can do as far as training or maybe holding officers more accountable for their actions to prevent these types of deaths and these decisions being made in the future?
You know, the sad part with that is, and I can't speak for every state. I'll speak for Florida standards and procedures as far as training officers and the use of deadly force, because I was one of the instructors at our academy for a number of years. Now I retired 7 years ago, but I'm sure that that training's still in place because it was a requirement. You know, part of the training in the recruit academy is for discretionary shooting, which is basically a high stress situation that you put the officer candidate through, and where they shoot, don't shoot, essentially. And that could be a situation in one of the buildings that we had at the academy where they use an airsoft weapons, they have protection equipment on, and they're actually shooting each other. You know, some people play bad guy, some people's a hostage. And the idea there is to stress them out so bad that they don't make bad shooting judgments. And then when they go to their agency, they're supposed to receive that training on a continual basis. I think that's where the training falls through the cracks, because a lot of agencies don't want to put the money into doing these shoot, don't shoot scenarios. Now, there's other equipment out there that's computer generated. My agency had it where, you know, basically you put the officer through the same thing with a weapon in their hand that has a laser type of a cartridge set up in it where it shoots a laser beam at the computer screen rather than a live piece of ammunition. And similar situation, you know, you got somebody yelling at the officer the whole time. You're trying to stress them out. So you're trying to cloud their judgment enough to, and during that stressful environment, that they're trying to think clearly. If they shoot the wrong person, you know, you counsel them on it, and you go back into the scenarios and you pick another one, and you run them through them again and again and again until they start making the right decisions. That's the way it works. You try to indoctrinate them through stress inoculation and give them something to look at. So when they react appropriately. And that could mean in anything from using a baton to pepper spray or a taser to finally the firearm, you know, depending on what the situation calls for, because they can go from immediately being there to shooting someone, or maybe they use a taser first and that doesn't work and then they have to shoot. But the idea is to inoculate them over and over and over and over, so when they get into a situation, they have at least had the training that prevents them from making mistakes. Now, am I saying that all officers are not going to make a mistake? Sometimes officers make a mistake. And if it's a legitimate mistake, it's a mistake, you know, but it should be admitted to and it should be dealt with appropriately. But when you have officers shooting people on purpose, like Michael Funk's case, where they shot him, that was not a mistake. That was them being hyped up, them not inoculated to deal with the stress. They had come out of a building and they were all freaking out, just go to show you how unprofessional they were. And they shoot a man in the street with no warning whatsoever. And the same thing with Michael Bell. You know, these four police officers with years of experience under their belt, they couldn't control this one man and they resorted to blowing his brains out because they were so exhausted they couldn't handle him. Then they should have just backed off from him for a second, you know, and used their tasers or used their pepper spray. None of that stuff was used on the Michael Bell case, and they were close enough to deploy those things. They just elected to just shoot him in the head. And in Michael Funk's case, is another assassination. And, you know, that's not proper. So training officers today, there is so many avenues to train them with. And if the agency itself doesn't have that equipment, I would guarantee you that a larger agency nearby, these smaller agencies, has that equipment and would have no problem letting those training units train those officers from the smaller departments. So when I hear they don't have it in their budget or some other nonsense, there's plenty of police agencies nearby the these cities that do have the equipment and that don't charge for it. It really just boils down to a police chief that doesn't care, who thinks that, oh, we don't have to worry about these things happening in our community because we're small, it's quiet, we don't have to worry about it. But what happens when these same clowns wind up going to a school shooting and they can't decide who the shooter is, and they shoot a student or two? What's going to happen then? You see, that's the problem that you have here when you don't train them right and you don't push that training over and over and over again to keep them on like a professional. Because when you don't train them like professionals, they don't act like professionals.
And then also talking about the problem, I know we've talked about this before on the podcast, but the relationship between the district attorney who's supposed to hold these officers accountable and these local law enforcement agencies or even the bigger city police departments, what can we do to make sure that there's no conflict of interest and they're actually investigating these without any prejudice?
Hold them accountable.
But how do we do that?
You know, these prosecutors, here's the problem with prosecutors and judges. They have immunity from improper investigations or improper calls, and that should be not allowed. They should have no immunity at all. When they knowingly fudge or cover up an investigation, then they should be prosecuted as well. And at some point, we have to bring in civilian review teams to also review these cases. And that could be, like I've mentioned before in previous, is grand juries. Grand juries typically in most counties, cities, states are 12 people from the community. They only sit for a certain amount of time. They're not paid. So, you know, they're not really politically motivated. They're not motivated to keep their job because there's benefits. So the fact of the matter is you've got 12 people from the community that pay taxes for the police and the prosecutors to have a job. And they can make a decision on whether or not that prosecutor or that police officer acted in a justifiable way or not. And I think that's what needs to happen around this country. And somewhere along the line, and this is hopefully will somewhere happen with the federal government, is have a agency set aside that reviews these kind of shootings that has no connection whatsoever to these agencies where you have these shootings that occur. Because when you want to tell me 98% of all police shootings are justified and only 2% are found to be not justified, there's no way. That's impossible. That's impossible to say that 98% of the shootings involved with police are justified. That's an impossible number.
But with the grand juries, isn't it left to the prosecutor to, because it's not, they don't give a defense. They can only present the evidence that they see as important. So how do you prevent that attorney from only presenting one side of it and not giving the full story in front of a grand jury?
Well, see, the grand jury, obviously, and this is what a lot of people don't understand, it. The grand jury is allowed to question every witness. So when the prosecutor starts bringing in evidence that seemingly supports, say, the police side of the story, the grand jury can question that. And I think at some point, if the grand juries don't use enough common sense to ask the right questions, someone should be appointed, an expert, you know, that can come in that's not part of either agency, that maybe is part of this other thing that the federal government can put into place, where they can educate the jury on use of force. They can educate the jury on the memory factors, shooting directions, blood spatter, all this stuff. You know, because the sad part is when you watch crime scene TV anymore today, the only ones they ever show are cases where they believe are all justified. You know, they were homicides or whatever the case may be. And then the drama TV shows really give people the wrong perception on how police investigations are done and the wrong perception on how crime scenes work. And that's something that grand juries need to be educated in to a certain degree, at least through common sense. When you looked at the Michael Bell's case, there was a lot of people that spoke out about the case openly because they recognized there were things wrong. And the same with Michael Funk. It was a huge outrage over it, but it's because they were able to contain it within the Wisconsin judicial system in both those cases, the officers were found to have justified shootings. But when you look at the civil side of it, where Michael Bell was able to collect over $1 million in the wrongful death of his son, that tells me clearly the shooting was not justified and the police actions were not justified. So, you know, there again, you know, why wasn't there criminal charges pursued against these officers after that?
Ira, did you have anything you wanted to add to that about the grand jury system?
The only problem with the grand jury system is that if a prosecutor wants to indict somebody, he can present the evidence to indict him. And if he doesn't want to indict somebody, he presents evidence against it. You know, one former United States prosecutor is quoted on saying, "I can indict a ham sandwich." They don't need the evidence. They can. All they have to do is fabricate it. And the same thing with the grand jury in going after a dismissal on the thing. They can just put the case together in such a way that the grand jury doesn't do anything. And then they make the transcripts of this mess secret, so nobody can review it. And when you're dealing in secrecy, everything goes on. Any crime can be committed, anything like that. Right now, the FBI deals in complete secrecy. We don't know what the hell they're doing. And you don't think for one second they're not pulling the wool over people's eyes? I can guarantee you they are.
Is there anything else you guys, we're about at an hour now, so is there anything else you guys want to add about both these cases before we go?
I'm still upset at the fact that these people haven't been criminally charged and that it's been covered up. Nothing we can ever do about it. And, you know, I'm still not going to stop, and neither is Sal, doing this kind of work. I am personally so glad we've got the Archangels of Justice Productions going that it's fantastic. We can maybe make a difference when people realize what's going on.
I could not agree more with you. And I hope that one day we can actually talk about solutions to prevent these needless shootings instead of partisan rhetoric that is little more than pandering by politicians for votes. Thank you, Sal and Ira, for sharing your experiences in these two cases. That is the end of this episode of Archangels of Justice Weekly. And remember, if you're looking to do something while you wait for the next episode of Archangels of Justice, you can get 2 free downloads from Audible by clicking the link at the top of archangelsofjustice.org's homepage. It is a great service and something that I personally use every day. From nonfiction to New York Times bestsellers to self-help books, you can educate yourself while you drive to work or while you work out. We always appreciate it if you leave comments or ratings on iTunes, as it helps other people find this podcast. Please follow us on Twitter and Facebook, or subscribe on YouTube so you don't miss any episodes from the upcoming season of the Leonard Peltier case. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also support us on Patreon, so we can continue bringing you great content. Lastly, if you use Amazon, make sure to click that link on the archangelsofjustice.org when you make your next purchase. From Sal, Ira, and I, thank you for listening, and we look forward to having you here for the next episode of Archangels of Justice Weekly.